MSW Media.
So, Fernando, does Judge Cannon's latest order make any kind of sense?
Boy, it's complicated. I'm Renato Mariotti. I'm a former federal prosecutor, a practicing lawyer, and a legal analyst.
And I'm Asha Rangappa. I teach national security law at Yale University. I'm a former FBI special agent, and I'm a legal analyst for ABC News.
I'm Brian Greer. I'm a former CIA attorney who specialized in everyone's favorite statute, the Espionage Act.
And we're here to help you understand topics that can't be boiled down into a soundbite or a tweet. So, Asha, I think you probably wanted a different adjective for that initial question. That was quite a bizarre order from Judge Cannon.
Yeah, can we just describe him? He was pretty short. It basically instructed both parties to come up with proposed jury instructions. I mean, we're pretty far from that, but maybe that's normal. But what was also unusual is that she outlined kind of two different scenarios, both of which I think kind of considered the Presidential Records Act as some form of defense or factual question to be determined by a jury. Neither of them made sense to me.
Yeah. So just to kind of set the stage here a little bit, jury instructions are something that the parties propose usually weeks before trial. There's a trial date that gets set far in advance. And a certain number of weeks out, the judge will have a pretrial conference. Usually there'll be a date, maybe 4 weeks out from the trial, where the judge will say, jury instructions are due on X date. Both sides submit proposed jury instructions, and the judge lines them up and essentially has a conference where he or she, in this case, figures out, looks at the two different proposed instructions on a particular point and makes decisions as to either which one she's going to offer or maybe a compromise between the two. That's the way things usually work. In this case, we don't have a trial date. If there is going to be a trial date, it's probably going to be pretty far in the future. And out of nowhere, she wants jury instructions on only this topic. And she hasn't really figured out what the law is. I mean, typically, if there are any disputes about what the law is, the judge figures that out. And then the parties decide, yeah, how to describe that to the jury. So this is all kind of bizarre from my perspective.
Yeah. And let me just give a quick primer on the Presidential Records Act. And then Brian can jump in. I did a video explainer for this on my Substack like a year ago. Basically, the Presidential Records Act was created in 1978 after President Nixon tried to walk off with everything that he had done and recorded in office. So basically, it was a recognition by Congress that we want to preserve some of these things. And it essentially creates a framework and categorizes records that are created and received in the course of an administration as either presidential records or personal records. And these are defined in the statute. And generally speaking, presidential records are any records that are created or received to assist the president in the execution of his presidential duties. And personal records are records that are purely private in nature or unrelated to the duties of the office. And, you know, there could be things that fall in the gray area between, but I think the idea is that generally, as the administration goes on, things should be being categorized as one or the other of these things so that the archivist can, you know, account for them. And at the end of the administration, all of the presidential records go to the archives. Anything that's been designated as personal can go with the president. So this could be like diaries or notes that they've taken. Just as a quick aside on why I think this is coming up now is that in 2012, Judicial Watch, which is, you know, kind of a right-wing legal organization, tried to sue the National Archives to get copies of tapes that Bill Clinton had made with an author who was writing a book maybe a biography or something like that. And NARA basically said, well, we don't have those. He took it with him. Those are his personal, he designated those as personal records. And so Judicial Watch said, well, NARA, you need to redesignate those as presidential records. And then, you know, and then we want them under FOIA. And basically NARA said, we can't do that. It went to, you know, and the court basically said, agreed and said, no, that designation was something for Clinton to make. They're sitting in his sock drawer. They're his. Tom Fitton has been in Trump's ear ever since this Mar-a-Lago stuff has started and basically said, look, based on this case, you know, nobody can question you if you just call these personal records because they wouldn't, you know, challenge Clinton's designation. So he's kind of hung his hat on this. And this has sort of become the, I think, illusory defense. And he brought it up in the course of the whole special master proceedings and all of this stuff. It reared its head there. And now he's kind of actually asserting it as a defense, and it makes no kind of sense. But anyway, so that's where I'll leave that. That's my big background for that.
But I think it's important to stress, like, the reason this was passed is, like you said, Nixon was taking records home, and it was to establish that, no, these records that are generated by the White House, at the White House, for the White House, they belong to the office, not to the person. And they belonged to the federal government, not to the person. And then you can really see personal records as the exception to that rule, right? There are going to be some purely personal things that are accepted, but that's the exception to the default, which is these are all official records. So,
yeah. And I mean, just to, you know, I think that there could be things that one could argue are in the gray area. Right? After the search warrant, for example, they recovered the Kim Jong-un love letter. I don't know. Maybe if somebody really wanted, if the president really wanted to take that home and they said that was a personal correspondence to me, and it's maybe. But I think to be clear, what we're talking about now are, I forget how many documents there are now, 31?
32.
Classified documents containing national defense information.
Yeah. And it appears, we don't know the full descriptions yet, but it appears, right, they're all records prepared by the intelligence community to brief the president. Like that's what we're talking about. And she has now seen them all. Like earlier back during the search, right? She hadn't seen them. She didn't know what was in there. Now as part of the CEPA proceedings, she's looked at all of them, knows exactly what's there, and is still seriously entertaining this notion that there's some argument that they're personal records.
So what are the two different scenarios that she outlines in this bizarre order?
Yeah, so I've got to have the document because they don't make a lot of sense. So she's asking the parties to assume that these scenarios are true statements of the law, and then how would you instruct the jury based on that? So in the first one is, in an Espionage Act prosecution, a jury is permitted to examine a record retained by a former president in his or her personal possession at the end of the presidency and make a factual finding as to whether the government has proven beyond a reasonable doubt that it is personal or presidential using the definition set forth in the Presidential Records Act. So that says basically it is an issue for the jury to decide that the government has to prove that these were presidential or personal. Now, part of that makes no sense. None of it makes sense, but the government would never prove their personal records. So that's not even necessary to say that. The government then would have to prove that these are presidential records. So the fact that that's a question for the jury basically concedes that the Presidential Act is relevant and it could trump the Espionage Act potentially.
It somehow suggests that it's plausible that documents containing national defense information could be personal records. Like, right. I mean, I don't even understand what this would look like. Like, the jury looks at a document containing our nuclear secrets and they and some 12 randos get to decide whether that's a Trump's personal record or not.
So, well, here's what I'd say. That you could imagine a scenario in which that's plausible, right? Like a president keeps diaries just for a purpose of keeping a diary and talks about a nuclear crisis and in it describes classified information.
Okay, but that's, I'm talking about this case.
Though. No, I understand for this case. But the thing to me that's really bizarre here is the Presidential Records Act, which is a civil statute, doesn't purport to trump or modify criminal statutes at all. And it really, and similarly, if the question here is purely, is there something about the Presidential Records Act which essentially immunizes Trump from prosecution for the possession of certain records? If that's not the case, it's not appropriate to put any of this in front of the jury. Whatever the jury decides here is irrelevant to the issue of his guilt or innocence. And I think to me, that is what is really bizarre about this. It's sort of like, you know, for example, if there was a bank robbery and the person's like, well, there's this new law regulating, you know, a particular type of financial instrument, and the jury has to decide whether the bonds that I stole are a particular type of instrument, and they need to determine this beyond a reasonable doubt. Well, like, why? Like, entering a bank with force and intimidation to obtain money or property or whatever is a crime. So, like, similarly here, you're taking and willfully taking national defense information, regardless of what the Presidential Record Act says, that's a crime. So that, to me, is why this is such a head scratcher.
Yeah, but I think she's trying to think about this in a way obviously favorable to Trump, but she's thinking through the elements of the crime. So it's going to be willful retention of national defense information without authorization to do so. And so DOJ concedes on the willfulness, which is Trump goes to Trump's mental state. Yeah, if he wants to argue to the jury that he thought, because Tom Fitton told him or whatever, that he was lawfully entitled to retain them, we'll let him do that. DOJ concedes he can do that. Now, there's boatloads of evidence to counter that, which we can talk about. So, but that's obviously not going to be very viable. And I think Cannon kind of knows that. There's Asha's point that there's no way this is national defense information. So I think Cannon said, I'm not going to go there. And then there's the unauthorized possession. And so here she's saying, I want to understand how this interacts with unauthorized possession. If he does, the fact that the Presidential Records Act allows a president to determine what's personal or not basically mean that the possession was authorized, put aside everything else? So it's a slightly harder question, but I still think easily dismissed, because no, that was not the intent of the Presidential Records Act, to give the president unilateral authority to say a highly classified government record is personal and therefore possession was authorized.
I authorized myself. Yeah. Essentially, what I think what the Trump position is whenever a president takes something home without declaring it or making any formal statement, they are de facto stating that it's personal, and thus they're authorized to do it. And it's really comes down to a line, Nixon line, right, where it's like, if the president does it, then it's not illegal. That's essentially, ironically, what this is saying, what this is about.
Yeah, but that would counter the entire purpose of the Presidential Records Act, because before the passage of that act, basically presidents could do whatever they wanted. They took whatever they wanted with them. They could, you know, give or donate some of it to some kind of, you know, presidential library or whatever. So if Trump's interpretation is correct, then it's basically, I'm able to do whatever all presidents before Nixon were able to do, which would then defeat the purpose of actually having this kind, what Brian said, that the default is that these are public records and that, you know, there has to be some determination made that these are not in any way related to official, you know, duties in order to walk off with them. Yeah.
And so to tie this together, and maybe to say that the world's not ending with this one, what if we accepted this view of the law, the DOJ would have to prove to the jury that they were presidential records beyond a reasonable doubt. Not really a fair statement of the law, but I think DOJ could ultimately live with that for the reasons we've discussed. They are obviously presidential records. It will be very easy for them to prove that, even if this is a sideshow that may confuse the jury. So could maybe live with this at the end of the day.
So what's the second scenario?
Yeah, so the second scenario gets to what Renato said earlier, which is basically saying that, no, the view of the law is the president taking these records home with them is basically ipso facto designating them as personal. I'll try to paraphrase. says a president has sole authority to categorize them as personal or presidential. Courts and juries can't review that decision. And although there's no formal means in the statute for a president to make that categorization, an outgoing president's decision to exclude what he or she considers to be personal records from presidential records given to NARA constitutes the president's categorization of them as personal. So he didn't send them to NARA at the end of this presidency. That is implicitly him designating them as personal. And the jury can't second guess that. That's what she's saying.
Can I just add one thing that, because I think it's an important footnote, that this court case that where Trump and his allies are drawing this language where a court says that, you know, it's up to the president, you can't challenge it, that same court case has language that says, we assume that when a president makes these designations, he's doing it in good faith. Like, he is doing it with an eye towards, you know, understanding what might have historical value, what, you know, like, to me, this has just been turned on its head. I'm sorry. Like, I think that to draw from, because she's drawing from that particular case, I think. She's drawing Trump's interpretation of what the court said in that particular case to take this, like, you can never challenge what the president said. Well, no one's ever had to challenge it because no one's ever done this before.
I think we all have established that there's something a little, and I'll use the NASA term, sketchy, about this order. From Judge Cannon. I think a lot of our listeners are like, okay, I've seen enough. What does this really mean? I mean, and I think I just want to say a few things and we'll see if the two of you agree with me or not. One thing I don't believe here is that there's some sort of scheme by Cannon to figure out how to get rid of this case. And like, this is her clever idea. In other words, if you really wanted to get rid of this case in a way that's not transparent, in a way that like it's unreviewable and totally saves Trump, there are a lot better ways to do that that don't show all your cards. And you could do it in a spot like, and I've talked about this in the past, like in the middle of the trial when Jeopardy's attached, where essentially it's unreviewable. She's not doing anything like that here. What she's doing is kind of putting some cards on the table. She hasn't even made a decision yet. And if she does, I think, you know, go in the route that, you know, I think you had it as option number two, Brian. I suspect what we're going to see is ultimately a review by the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. Like, I think if she ultimately makes that legal determination, my prediction would be that the special counsel is going to try to seek what's called a writ of mandamus. I could be wrong, but I right? It's going to have a broader implication.
If she makes a determination like that it's, the instructions should be the second scenario.
Right. If the president, yeah, I'm determining as a legal matter that if the president takes classified documents, it means that it is legal, essentially, under the PRA.
But what about, why couldn't he appeal it for the first scenario too?
I don't know if they would, because they could meet it. I think they'd say it's silly, but we'll meet it. But yeah, let's game it out. So the parties now have to submit instructions. On the second prong, what's DOJ going to say? I think they're going to just say, I would predict, if this is the law, the case has to be dismissed because there's nothing to argue. Because even the, and I've pointed this out online, and some smart commentators have said, well, they would still have to prove, there would still have to be evidence at trial that Trump put on by Trump to establish that, no, he designated them as personal or whatever. And therefore, that would go to the jury. And then maybe at most, there would be a directed verdict by her in Trump's favor. That doesn't now allow for any appeal. I think DOJ will say, look, our indictment alleges, this is all coming up in a motion to dismiss. In a motion to dismiss, you accept the allegations of the indictment as true. The indictment alleges that he didn't send any of these to NARA, that he took them all to Mar-a-Lago. So basically, it alleges what's in this prong too, that he didn't send them in. Judge, rule now. If you think this is the view of the law, just dismiss the case now so we can appeal, is basically what they're going to beg the court to do, I would think. Whether she'll go that far or not, will she just hold this instruction in her back pocket? We'll see. I think that's the big question.
Right. So until she does something, just so everyone understands, there's really nothing to appeal because she hasn't made a decision. The fact that she's exploring all of this publicly and throwing this out there suggests to me she's actually struggling to sort of get her head around all of this. It really suggests somebody who is having trouble getting her head around a complicated area of the law and something she's not familiar with. I mean, it's interesting because we talk a lot about qualifications for judicial candidates. She's relatively inexperienced, relatively junior, hasn't tried a lot of cases, certainly doesn't have much experience in the national security area. I think a lot of judges would deal with their questions about something like this in a hearing where they would get both sides in there and ask a lot of pointed questions to try to understand. So this is an unusual way of going about it. But I think regardless, just so everyone understands, because I've been getting a lot of questions like this, I don't think this is part of some plan. I think she's really trying to figure out what she wants to do. If she ultimately sides against the government on this one, I do think that against the prosecution, there's going to be an appeal here one way or the other. But I definitely think, and I believe you agree with me on this, Brian, that this is just yet another indicator that this thing's going nowhere fast.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's a ton of other issues she seems to be planning on and not deciding that we can talk about, but I think so. And not to potentially end on a bad note too, the next question, one of the next questions is going to be Trump's presidential immunity assertion, right? And that assertion is technically separate from this, but it is still based on the Presidential Records Act, which is his alleged designation of these records as personal was the official act of a president that entitles him to immunity. She hasn't decided that yet. She'll probably hold a hearing on it. And if she thinks that that argument, even if she doesn't agree with it, if she thinks it's non-frivolous, she will stay the case pending Trump's appeal of that immunity assertion. So if you had any hope before that she might find this presidential act argument to be frivolous, I think that's gone now, right? I think it is frivolous for all the reasons we've discussed. She clearly thinks it's not. And so in terms of going nowhere fast, I think we're almost guaranteed of a stay at this point when we get to immunity.
Yeah. You know, Renato, to your point that she's kind of in over her head, maybe intellectually. I mean, I think it's of a piece with how she handled the whole special master thing. It's like she takes these like wacky things that are coming from the Trump camp. And I mean, look, I get that he's a former president. It's important to make sure that she gives proper consideration, but it almost seems like she goes a little bit overboard, right? Like, as you said, she's not like considering it and getting like an actual understanding of the law. It's like she, I mean, in the special master case, I mean, she basically exercised equitable, like she created a whole, you know, extraordinary jurisdiction just to like entertain the case. And then, you know, didn't really understand like how executive privilege works. By the way, didn't we establish back then that his whole claim that these were covered by executive privilege would by definition make them presidential records? Like, WATF. Okay, WTAF is what I meant.
Well, the ATF's a great agency. I know what you
but
mean.
Do you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't even know that she fully understands that the argument that she entertained with regard to the special master is now completely at odds with the argument that she is entertaining.
Sure.
Now,
I hear you. I mean, I that was the reason that I kind of framed things the way I did, because I think there's a lot of theories out there about what's really going on. And, you know, just to get maybe even provide more context. You know, one thing that we had we had a back and forth in the last episode, Asha, between like lied versus misled. And why do I say misled versus lied and yada, yada, yada? To me, people who have like a plan and know that there's something shady about it or sneaky about it, they often, Bill Barr is an example of this, the former attorney general, Alan Dershowitz, where they kind of know there's a BS element to what they're doing. They're very careful with their words and they do these like little sly things. And if Cannon was some smooth operator, she could totally figure out all sorts of ways to sort of do this in a much more elegant fashion that would raise fewer questions and fewer alarm bells. And she's just sort of like muddling through. And whether that's a good or bad thing, you know, I don't know, because frankly, the fact that at least there's transparency and people can see what she's trying to do and what she's up to and the Court of Appeals can review it, there's something good there, because that's how our system should work. Things should be transparent. courts of appeals should be able to weigh in if a judge is making an error and so on. And so at least that's happening here. Unfortunately, it's not happening anytime fast, which could be very relevant depending on how the election turns out.
Basically, you're saying she's not the brightest bulb in the box.
I didn't say that about a sitting judge, but Asha did. I think
she's smart. I think it's more of judgment and in bias and everything. Like she's smart. I think she's thinking about this stuff hard. Yeah. I mean, like, I think she's truly thinking here.
She might be thinking about it hard. That doesn't make
no,
her
I know,
smart.
but she's like book smart, right? Like, but not, it does not translate into judicial competence in any way, putting aside her bias, putting aside the politics and everything. Like, you can still be book smart and have horrible judgment and not know how to operationalize that in any context, especially as a judge. And that's sort of where I would put her, putting aside the bias stuff. Because like this unauthorized possession issue is a little more nuanced and harder than sort of our gut reaction to this. She's thinking about it at a deeper level, but still, it's still bonkers. Like the fact that you would put that second prong in there is bonkers. It just truly is.
Well, whatever. It's nice of you guys to really give her this much benefit of the
doubt. I think she's, as you guys were talking, I was thinking she's probably like, it's trying to do Trump favors, right? Because she knows, again, it this all may be relevant to willfulness, like we talked about, but she's got to know that that's a loser argument. I mean, let's review. Trump claimed that these records were planted by the FBI, right? When the raid happened. Why would he have done that if they were personal? He claimed that he declassified them all. Why would he need to be claiming all that if they were personal?
He claimed they were covered by executive privilege.
Did that too. He gave most of them back to NARA, right? Most he gave back. Why would he do that if they were all personal? Then he gave a bunch more back in response to a grand jury subpoena. Why would he do that for personal? And then he hid a bunch of them and lied about it to everybody. Why would he do that if they were personal? So she knows this relevance to willfulness is just going to be a total loser. And I think she's trying to think of, smartly, the right way to bring it up and help him.
It is interesting. One thing that I hope that our listeners are understanding here, because this is a podcast about sort of the law as it is, not the law as it is taught in textbooks and so forth. You know, the court you're in and the judge you draw makes such a big difference in a case. You know, back many months ago, we were lining up all of the criminal cases. I think we put, you know, Alvin Bragg's case at the bottom. We put this case at the top in terms of the potential downside for Trump. And here we are with this case going nowhere fast and maybe going in a direction favorable to him. And yet, Donald Trump still looks like he's going to trial in Manhattan in a month.
So, Renato, what's your solution to the perfect night's sleep?
It used to be more complicated, but Cozy Earth makes it simple with their ethically made luxury bedding. It's super soft and perfect for any season, so you're no longer the hot sleeper.
Exactly. It's about comfort that cares for the planet. And sleeping on Cozy Earth, it's like a hug for your whole body.
We love working with Cozy Earth, and they're offering you 35% off site-wide when you use the code COMPLICATED at CozyEarth.com.
Opening up my Cozy Earth sheets was a wow moment. The feel and quality are just top-notch. Sleeping on them is like a mini vacation every night, all cozy and calm. Plus, they're amazing at keeping the temperature just right, no matter what time of year it is.
Getting my Cozy Earth sheets was a total sleep upgrade. They're super soft and eco-friendly thanks to the bamboo viscose. Every night, I feel the luxury and love that's woven into them. Plus, being on Oprah's favorite things for several years means you know that they're worth it.
Cozy Earth offers a 100-night sleep trial and a 10-year warranty, which speaks volumes about their confidence in the product's quality. It's comforting to know that they stand behind their bedding with such strong guarantees.
Indeed. And Cozy Earth's range isn't just limited to sheets. They've extended their commitment to luxury and sustainability to their entire collection, including ultra-comfortable loungewear and plush bath towels.
Whether you're winding down for the night or starting your day, Cozy Earth enhances every moment with unparalleled comfort. It's clear that Cozy Earth isn't just creating products. They're crafting an experience of comfort and sustainability that's hard to find anywhere else.
If you've never tried Cozy Earth, I've got great news. You can save up to 35% off Cozy Earth right now. Go to CozyEarth.com and enter my promo code, COMPLICATED, at checkout for up to 35% off on your first order.
That's CozyEarth.com, promo code, COMPLICATED.
So, Asha, we have some other really interesting news this week. It turns out that Donald Trump is not able to come up with a $464 million bond, which is interesting because he's made everyone believe that he's got many billions of dollars. Elena Haba says he's got millions and millions in cash. He's got tons of cash. He's super rich. And I think a lot of people are wondering what's going on with this bond, because the obvious implication from the fact that he cannot get a $464 million bond is that he's not as wealthy as he claims to be.
Yeah. I'm smiling because this whole thing brings to mind that song that became popular during COVID. It was, I think, a TikTok song called You about to lose your job.
You're fired.
And that's what it makes me think of. Like, yeah, I think the enforcement proceedings are about to begin, and he's gonna lose it all. He testified during his trial that he basically had $400 million in cash, like sitting around under his mattresses or something like that. So obviously that's not true. But also, I think I read that he's been turned down by like 30 surety companies.
Yes.
And so they are looking at this. I mean, they're insurance companies, so they have underwriters. So I guess they must be looking at, A, what's the likelihood that he's going to win this appeal? B, if he loses the appeal, what's the likelihood that we're going to recover our money?
Right. So I'll just say, because I've been talking a lot publicly about this. I've done a lot of interviews and so on in the subject. And the reason why I've talked about it is it's something I have a lot of experience with. I have represented large real estate developers. I currently represent large real estate developers, and I've investigated and prosecuted large real estate developers. And they are highly illiquid. Okay. So that's one thing I'll say, that usually real estate developers are highly leveraged. You know, they'll have hundreds of millions in property, but their net worth is less than that sort of thing. They can turn that empire into cash, and sometimes they have to, and they've had to in cases that I've been on both sides on, because you think you're going to get indicted, or you think you're going to get convicted, or you think you've got a lawsuit judgment coming, or whatever it might be. And that usually involves sale of property, or refinance. And that does take time. But what this means for Donald Trump is one of two things, right? One is what we've just said, which is that he's been lying all along about his wealth. Another, and it also could be, you could have both be true, is that he totally blundered and did not account for at all the fact that this judgment, which was highly likely to be imposed on him, was going to occur. In other words, it's not like the attorney general's lawsuit's been going on a few days. It's been going on for years. He took the fifth hundreds of times. He had to know he was going to lose. He had to know he was going to lose big. Any prudent real estate developer in that circumstance would have started putting properties up for sale years ago, started refinancing properties years ago. The fact that he didn't, it shows just like a massive strategic blunder on his part, or it means that he just doesn't have anywhere near the assets, so just continuing to bluff is his only play. But one or the other is true, and neither of them, I think, are very good qualities for somebody who's wanting to be the president of the United States again.
So what now? So he can't find a surety company who's going to put up this bond and take his collateral and accept his collateral as having the value that he says it does. So And if he can't put up the bond, then he cannot appeal. And if he cannot appeal, then the judgment can be enforced. And I forget when the deadline is that Letitia James would be able to start.
He can appeal. He just, the enforcement is not stayed.
I see. Okay. Yeah. So she can still start. I see. So the appeal, so the posting of the bond
stays enforcement.
Only stays the enforcement. Okay. Got it.
Right. So for example, so just to play this out a little bit, and for what it's worth, I've actually had some surety underwriters reach out to me recently after I made some public comments to give me their thoughts on it. Because I'm not an underwriter. I'm a lawyer who represents people in this space. But essentially, what one guy told me is you would require, you know, in a case where there's an appeal of a judgment, 100 to 200% in this context, in terms of collateral. And the reason why you'd want that is if it's cash, it'd be more like 100%, 1-to-1. You'd want its collateral.
They have costs associated with enforcement.
Right, exactly. And then you might want 200% if it's real estate because you'd have a fire sale element to it, right? In other words, if there's an appeal and he loses, and the company has to foreclose on that real estate, they've got to sell it quickly. You're not going to get top dollar. And so what Trump's going to be trying to do in the short run, I would think, if he has any sense, is he should be trying to sell properties, trying to refinance properties, and trying to fight collection efforts, right? And try to coordinate with the other entities that own pieces of his property, because I doubt he owns any of them outright. I'm sure there's consortiums of lenders and so forth that are involved in a lot of these. He's going to be trying to negotiate with them to slow things down as much as he can in the hopes that he can win or have, you know, or at least get a partial win on appeal. That's what's going to be going on. And it's expensive and it's a disruption to his business and so forth.
And when is the deadline? Like when does Letitia James have the green light?
It's very soon in terms of starting enforcement proceedings. But just to be clear, I mean, she's overstating things a bit when she's like, I can't wait. I'm looking at this building and I'm going to take it into, you know, we're going to grab it. You know, most of these buildings are really owned by a bunch of lenders. It's like your house, right? If there's a judgment against me, somebody could put a lien on my house, but the bank that really owns a majority interest in my house is going to have something to say about it. And it's not just going to, you know, they're not going to go away. Right.
I mean, she's going to be second, third, fourth in line. Presumably this is exactly why the surety companies aren't super happy with taking all of these buildings as collateral.
Right.
My question is, let's say he gets quote unquote buyers, someone whose name rhymes with Vladimir Gluten, for example, or somebody else in that kind of space. The New York judge also appointed a monitor, a babysitter for the Trump org, and that's Judge Barbara Jones.
Right.
So would she be monitoring all of these kinds of transactions so he can't do anything completely sketchy or could he theoretically, either through selling assets and property, get money from, say, foreign sources, or even get cash outright from foreign sources? Would there be any guardrail there because we do have this Trump organization babysitter watching everything?
A very smart question. Because I think one thing I'll just say is, you know, I hope that our listeners are understanding when we consider your question, how difficult this is for a business. Okay. Because like literally it's like they can't do anything. They're not only facing all of these pressures to try to come up with all this money in the short term, but they literally can't even do what they want without talking to the babysitter. The short answer, I think, is, you know, if you're selling, let's just say you're selling at 100% or more, okay, of the value of a property. And Elon Musk, let's start domestic here. Elon Musk wants to buy your properties for 100% value. I think everyone, it throws a party and pops some champagne. That's in everybody's interest. That's in Trump org's interest. That's in the lender's interest. That's in everyone's interest, maybe other than Elon Musk's. So if he's going to do that, I think that there are, you know, if people want to come out of the woodwork and bail out Trump, that's possible. But those people have to take into account the fact that they're outlaying, like they're putting out serious money, okay, on value, you know, to a guy who just got found liable for fraud and inflating valuations or whatever. And, you know, they're only buying his interest. And if they want to buy out everyone's interest, I mean, who wants to own 100% of all these properties and all, you know, suddenly take them over and they're worth a lot more to Trump than they are to you, right? I mean, if I own Mar-a-Lago, it's worth a lot less to me than it is to Trump, who can monetize it in ways that I can't, because people don't want to go to my ballroom in the same way they want to go to Trump's and so on.
If you kept classified documents in your bathroom, then you might get maybe some people there.
Maybe. Or sold, you know, whatever. I sold influence or something. But I'm not as influential, right? So anyway, the foreign point is interesting. You know, I would have to think that from a monitor's perspective, they're purely looking out for the financial side of it. And to me, that's a national security issue. That's somebody else's problem, right? I mean, if you're appointed as a monitor, you're looking to make sure that they're not doing something, to use an Asha word, shady, from a financial perspective. But if like some Russian oligarch shows up and he's like, okay, I'll give you $1 billion for some property, and that's higher than what an appraiser thinks it's worth, you know, I don't know why the monitor cares. Interesting question.
Yeah, and I think we still don't know who put up the collateral for the bomb that was posted in E. Jean Carroll too.
Yeah, I mean, and I think I've been hanging out with you long enough to know that part of what the point that you're trying to make implicitly is we have somebody who could be our president who may be easily compromised by foreign governments. And from a counterintelligence perspective, we should be concerned about. And I think that's an interesting point.
Yeah. And I'll just add, I think even from a domestic standpoint, to use the Elon Musk example, Elon Musk owns one of the most powerful information platforms in the country. And if he has or will have any financial interest at stake, then he also has an interest in making sure that Trump gets to be president. Because they're going to, you know, I don't know, that Trump seems to have a way of siphoning off things from the U.S. Treasury to, you know, his properties and other people. In other words, like, I think you're right. It's a national security risk from the foreign influx standpoint of any kind of cash. But I don't think it's necessarily any less problematic if it's a billionaire here, particularly somebody like Elon Musk, who has a lot of power.
You know, he's also a big defense contractor, right? Mm-hmm. Through Starlink and so forth. So I think that, you know, the point that you're making is really why presidents, and I was going to say traditionally, but really every president other than Trump has essentially divested themselves of their assets, put them in blind trusts and so forth, and, you know, so that this way there is no potential conflict of interest. Trump stands alone as a president who had very substantial business holdings and really refused to do what other presidents have done in order to ensure that there's no conflict of interest. And so, yes, will he be beholden to someone? He very well may. And if he isn't, he's going to be in a very complicated and challenging financial situation where he's highly illiquid. He's going to lose a substantial part of whatever his fortune is if he's forced to sell things in a fire sale. He's going to have very substantial costs and bitter court fights. And he's going to, of course, have a court monitor and so forth watching all at the same time. And this was, by the way, what we ranked probably as the lowest of his legal problems, right, compared to these criminal indictments. It's a more significant problem, I think, than people perhaps give it credit for. So, Asha. A couple of weeks ago, we talked a little bit about you sneaking out as a teenager, and I think we said that we were going to get back to that subject. So how prolific were you at sneaking out of your parents' home?
So a Okay, I feel like there has to be context here.
I was that's very prolific. That's what that means.
So look, I was a good kid, but my best friend Danielle was pretty wild, and you know, so she kind of bounced me out, and she was a very prolific sneaker outer, and she, you know, she drove, she had her car, and I happened to have a balcony right outside my bedroom door.
Were you on the first floor?
No, I was on the second floor.
Holy cow. How high up was this balcony?
It was definitely like a second floor balcony, but then, you know, there were ways that you could get footholds to like get down.
Oh my God. This is like a parkour thing.
It is.
Okay.
But I would be proactive because we had a sliding door on the first floor in the back. So I would leave that unlocked for the rear entry for the return entry so that when I came back, I didn't, especially, you know, because we were going to parties and stuff. I didn't want to be like climbing up a balcony
when I got drunk. Yeah.
Yeah. But I will say this. In general, I didn't have to do it that much because my best friend was somebody that my parents loved. I don't know if you had one of these best friends that was like a total bad influence, like a party person, but your parents thought they were like an angel. As long as you were with that person, like you were in safe hands. So my parents treated Danielle like a daughter, and they thought that she was, you know, if I was with Danielle, there's no questions asked, ironically enough. So a lot of times I would just spend the night with her.
Wow. Quote unquote. Of course. It's interesting. So my stepdaughter has certain friends that my wife thinks are the bee's knees, and they're super great. And even boyfriends at times, she's like, oh, he's so great and he's so polite and this and that. And I'm like super suspicious of any teenage boy. Okay. Like I assume they have bad motives. I'm just that kind of person in general. I've been through too much. So I'm like, okay, this kid seems sketchy. I'm always thinking of the downside, and my wife's like, oh, they're great. And so, yes, now I'm going to share this segment with her because she needs to hear this.
Yeah.
So how much trouble did you get into? Were there ever times where you were like, you couldn't go home because things like, you know, whatever, like you were in a space where if you came home, like it was too early, you had stayed out too late and your parents might be awake or something like that?
No, I don't. I mean, I don't know. Like, I mean, I think about times when I came home and maybe my parents just had no idea like what signs to look for, or like evidence of like, you know, I mean, look, I wasn't like doing drugs or anything like that. I never did that, but you know, I'd be out late. I did drink in high school.
Really?
So yeah, I know. That makes me feel ashamed to say that, but I did. Which actually, frankly, meant that when I went to college, that really wasn't like a big deal for me. And
yeah.
I think I was much more moderate and focused on my schoolwork and stuff because I wasn't one of these kids who got to college and was like, oh my God, this is the first time I've ever seen alcohol in my life. But, you know,
right.
And can get wasted. So, so I think that part actually served me well.
Were the parties and all that a distraction when you're in high school? Was it like hard to be focused on studies?
We were usually like after football games. Sometimes Danielle and I would go up to ODU, Old Dominion University, and go to like some of those frat parties. I can't believe I did this.
Wow.
Like, I look at my own kid. My kids are so good now. I don't know.
Them listen to the segment.
I know. Now I'm feeling like I shouldn't have done this segment.
This is great. Well, that's that. If you listen to the end of this podcast, you've learned something that I bet Asha's own family doesn't know. Both your parents and your kids would be like, OMG.
Yeah, my parents don't know. I mean, you know, and we can talk about this another time too. Like, I was a cheerleader. And so there was a whole lifestyle that came with that.
Oh, wow. All right, we're going to have to compare notes we can talk about on a future episode. We'll talk about my high school experience. Very different from yours. Very different from yours.
Fair enough.
MSW Media.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.